Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Kid Across the Hall, The Fight for Opportunity in Our Schools, by Reed Saris. Narrated by Mike Lenz. Notes on Sources. This book is not fiction, and it is not strictly nonfiction either. I set out to write the truth as I experienced it, and found out along the way that doing so in the context of this story is complicated. Students have an expectation of privacy when they attend school, and so, in this book, character names and features have been changed to protect their privacy. Schools, districts, and states with whom I have partnered over the years also have an expectation of privacy, so their details have been changed as well. As in most schools, teachers, where I taught, often served hundreds of students a year. Simultaneously, they interacted with a significant portion of the other 70 teachers in the school, as well as with the administrators and parents. I found it difficult to keep this many people straight in my mind, even while spending most of my waking hours with them. To share a breadth of stories and keep things manageable for listeners, I've created character, class, dialogue, event, and school composites. During the writing process, we engaged dozens of readers and asked them to assess the accuracy of the text and to help ensure that it conveys what the experiences they were part of were actually like. Their edits have improved the book tremendously and brought it closer to nonfiction. Beyond reading and editing the manuscript, a group of six of my former students collaborated on the actual writing of the student dialogue. Instead of eliminating dialect, they endeavored to convey different ways of speaking more genuinely, in the hope that doing so honors the diverse language and heritage of students. Any profits this book may generate will go to my sister, my students, and not-for-profits. Contemporaneously with the events described, my family and I kept journals, and those have been consulted to help reconstruct events and experiences. These statistics, analysis, and research studies directly included in and informing this book have been carefully developed and reviewed for accuracy, including original analysis of public and private data pertaining to millions of educators and students across a wide variety of variables, and comprehensive research reviews and meta-analyses conducted by the author, by the United States Department of Education, by the team at Equal Opportunity Schools, and by hundreds of academic scholars. Though I didn't used to think I'd ever fess up to such a thing, there will probably still be mistakes in the text, as there were in many of my actions recounted in it. And that's on me. Part 1. Chapter 1. When she first graced the doorstep of our house in the woods, 6-year-old Erin Marie was joining her 10th family. I was a lonely, only child, 9 years old, who'd never had to move, and I loved my new sister. We ran child-wide smiles and imagination all over our garden, which overflowed with plants native to Washington State, like story-tall rhododendrons of a dozen colors beneath 100-foot-tall firs. I showed her the treehouse and the sandbox, all the best places to play. I showed her the bunk beds, Big Bear, and my carpeted loft with a window that looked down onto a street lamp by a cluster of vine and flowered-covered mailboxes. From my Aunt Susie, I had my most prized possession, an old coin dispenser used by train conductors. You put the pennies, dimes, nickels, and quarters in the top and press a little lever below to release them one at a time. Once I'd shown Erin how it worked, I extended it to her with both hands to say, "Here, this is ours now. It's all ours." With a steady diet, her own room, good sleep, and a regular schedule, Erin rebounded from malnutrition, growing several inches in her first months with us. She was in the spring of her life. We took a trip to play in the tulip fields. We went to the rocky ocean beaches, and I showed her how to find the best little crabs, to hold them on her palms and feel the tickle of their soft scuttle, how to keep her hands over water in case they fell, and how to clean off with kelp gel. Her energy and her curiosity were enchanting. She wanted me to read her every book, show her every game. We traced all the known paths in the woods behind the house and made new ones, restrung an old swing between two giant evergreens with two long ropes and one thick plank to connect them. Then I sat on the plank, and she sat on my lap, and we pumped our legs way up into the budding maple leaves in front of us, and back over the huckleberries, Oregon grapes, and stands of sword ferns. Finally, after so many years living next to an empty bedroom while my parents had looked far and wide to find my sister, things were as they should be. We seemed to have all we needed: family, food, and the space to grow, love, and learn. I wish I would have always followed my instinctual love for Aaron, as I did in those early days as her brother, when it seemed that, together, we could make the world wonderful for the both of us. "How were your days, you two?" my mom, a school counselor, asked us over dinner at a round teak table, which seemed to grow out of our moss-green carpet next to our forest-filled windows. "We went over to Ardmore and played on the slides and stuff." "How was it, Aaron?" "Fun," she said, smiling back politely. "What was your favorite part?" "Playing with my brother." She looked over at me, and then, when I looked back with a smile, she looked down and scooped up a bite of microwave scrambled eggs. "What did you learn?" my dad, an engineer, asked us, wiping his beard with a paper napkin. "That I like playing with my sister," I said. "When are we going to do the adoption anyways?" My parents looked at each other while Aaron and I studied them. "Well, like we said," my mom responded, "we need to think about that and figure out what's best, Reed." "What do you mean, what's best? Is there something better than this?" "Well, aren't we ready?" I pushed. "I can talk with you more about it later, Reed," she said softly. "How was your day, Gary?" He told us about a wind tunnel and some of his friends' latest ideas about how to give tons of metal enough lift to fly, while Aaron and I ate our peas, carrots, and corn, just warm enough to melt the pat of butter we'd each been given as a topper. When I talked later with my mom, she said that we'd be doing foster care for a while with Aaron, and then, hopefully, adoption. But I didn't understand it. They'd searched the world for years to find a daughter to adopt. Romania, Peru, Colombia, Guatemala, Texas. And finally found Aaron right here. So what's the problem? She said some things about professional caseworkers and recommendations and the idea that what was best would be to try things out and build from there. When I told her it didn't make sense, she said there were things about Aaron's history that were, well, complicated and potentially challenging, and it's important to be thoughtful. We'll see how things go, sweetie, and hopefully it'll all work out. Since I had no idea what the complicated things might be, or how such things worked, I shrugged okay. I gave Aaron my first bicycle, which had rainbows painted on it. My parents upgraded me to a black mountain bike with more gears and thicker treads to ride the jumps. My best friend, Jamie, became her friend. We all rode bikes together by the school one day, Aaron following us off-road, even though her bike wasn't made for it. When she fell off and crumpled up, crying in the dirt next to the dry grass, I raced back to get my parents while Jamie waited with her. Feeling guilty that my little sister had the wind knocked out of her, I nearly knocked myself out, crushing the pedals homeward and swerving up into our driveway to find help as quickly as I could. So stupid of me. I leaped off, slamming my new bike down on the pavement. "Mom, Dad, come quick and get Aaron!" After telling them, she fell. I started heaving out tears. As my mom put a hand on my face to comfort me, I pulled away and said, "No, we have to get Aaron." Not knowing how hard it would get, I felt that being a good big brother meant I should try my best to take care of my little sister. Physically, Aaron was fine. Though I was unusually tall, that first year she grew more quickly than I did. And because now we both had a 6'2" mom and a 6'5" dad, I figured we'd both get to be tall. But my parents told me that even with her growth spurt, Aaron couldn't get there. Her biological parents were short, and she'd lost important growing time in the first 6 years. The doctors forecast that I would always be in the 99th percentile, and that Aaron would never be close to tall enough to get into the Tip Toppers Tall Club, where my parents had first met. I had just qualified for a program for gifted and talented students, which my mom got me into by having me retested after I hadn't qualified the first time. Meanwhile, I heard that the testers had concluded that Aaron was mentally retarded. So they wanted to pull us both out of regular classes and put us in special classes. My type of special was talked about as being full of high capabilities and endless possibility, while hers was discussed in terms of disability, which sounds like the opposite of ability. I didn't see Aaron and her classmates when I was at school. They had separate classrooms, and I'm not sure how much her teachers even took them to recess. I don't remember seeing them out there. I went to recess with the regular kids, but as soon as the bell rang, my group got to enter the first classrooms on the leading edge of the school, with the most external walls and tall windows. My teacher seemed to have the most training and experience, and took us on the most incredible trips, like to Washington, D.C., Monticello, and her very own log cabin. And while she talked a lot about social justice, she never mentioned how it was determined who got to be in what were considered to be the good special classes with us. So the fact that kids who looked and dressed like me were the ones categorized as talented seemed at the time as natural as the leaves outside our tall windows being green. My mom believed that the testers had been too hasty in their judgment, calling Aaron retarded, when maybe she'd been reluctant to engage with adults because she was traumatized. After my mom had the school retest Aaron, they decided she wasn't retarded after all. Together, Aaron and I had now gotten every result on these supposedly rigorous tests of intellectual capability. She'd been retarded and normal, and I'd been normal and gifted, our designations changing when we were retested at the request of my mom, who worked in and knew how to work the system. My friend Jamie went the other way, showing up at the summer school for gifted kids where we met, and then getting put in regular classes when he started middle school. I'd been told time and again that I was talented, that anything was possible, and I just assumed that applied to others the same way, that Aaron and Jamie could also accomplish anything they wanted. In the intensive family therapy that Aaron's caseworker assigned us to, I was told otherwise. Two therapists, a man and a woman, led us. Aaron, I understand that this week you were disobedient to Carolyn and Gary on several different occasions. Why do you think that is? I what? She asked, some of her freckles folding into flinch wrinkles around her eyes as she scanned the room to try to see what this panel of four adults and me might have in store for her. For this to work out, you would need to do a better job of listening to Carolyn and Gary. They're responsible for you, and they know what is needed, and it's your job to listen to them and respond appropriately, to do what they say. Okay? Okay? She asked, perhaps recalling all the adults who told her to do things that were not appropriate. You want to do a good job in the family, don't you? The other therapist asked. Aaron didn't immediately respond. Aaron, I said you want to do a good job in this family, don't you? Yes. I'm not doing good? Feeling immense tension, I offered, I think she's doing a pretty good job. That's good, Reed. That's very nice of you. Maybe we can come back to that. For now, let's focus on the two incidents that you raised, Carolyn. Do you want to describe what happened? And, Aaron, we need you to listen carefully because I'm going to ask you why you chose to behave the way you did. I slid farther back on the couch next to my parents. We all watched Aaron, hunched in a little chair, nod slightly at the floor, her neatly folded hands in her lap, where her knee-length skirt met her navy blue cotton tights. So my concern, my mom started in. Then, noticing Aaron, she restarted. I think there's been a lot of progress. Things had been going better for a while, Aaron. I appreciate how you've been picking up after yourself in your room, and how you'd been listening better, but I don't understand what happened these last couple days in particular. Like yesterday, when you had a meltdown and threw that big tantrum about your hair. I couldn't sense Erin moving at all. In her stillness, she seemed alert, absorbing everything. I've told you that if you want to keep your hair long, then you need to take care of brushing it. Otherwise, it gets tangled in knots, and it's unmanageable. Does that make sense? Erin, Carolyn is asking you a question, offered one of the therapists. Erin looked up timidly at the therapist, who pointed a thumb at my mom. Erin scanned over to her and then back to the floor. My mom repeated her question. Does it make sense that if you want to keep your hair long, you need to be taking care of it? Yes. And when I told you that you haven't been successfully taking care of it, and that we were going to have to cut it, then you started yelling and screaming, and were throwing pillows around your room, and you wouldn't calm down. What was going on for you? Erin said something. Pardon? I don't want short hair, she said to the painted cement exposed at the edge of the area rug. I understand that, my mom responded. But you need to show that with your actions, and you haven't been doing it, and we've given you lots of chances. So, like I said yesterday, we're going to have to cut. Things happened quickly from there. Crying for Erin, commands from the therapists to stop screaming, to please get up off the floor and get back in the chair. That if she didn't improve her behavior and stop the noise, the rest of us would leave the room until she calmed down. Then we were all watching Erin from outside the room through what I had mistaken for a mirror on the wall of the therapy room. Eyes wide and teeth clenched, I stood back while the therapists explained what they believed was happening. I think we may have some oppositional defiant disorder elements here, triggered by severe attachment disorder. She just doesn't want to listen anymore, and she won't respond and do what's being asked of her. I thought of my biggest tantrum. My parents had told me over and over that I needed to wear a helmet if I was going to be allowed to use my bike. And when they caught me riding without one for the third time in a row, they locked up my bike. Jamie and I had been planning to ride down to the lake. I was screaming at my mom through the window, saying I wanted my bike back so I could go. And when she refused, I told her it was too bad that I was a son of a bitch, and then I ran off. That was way worse than my little sister not brushing her hair and crying about having to get it cut short. Can't we just go in there and give her a hug or something? I asked. She's really upset. Reed, listen, said one of the therapists to me before breathing in, then smiling. The pattern of Erin's behavior is quite concerning. You're probably not aware of all that's happened to her, but she is very much in need of treatment, attachment therapy, and more. If we're to prevent... Well, I'll let your parents discuss that with you. Erin sobbed on the other side of the glass. She lay on her side, holding her hair in her hands. To prevent Erin from becoming a predator like her father, they said that my mother should hold Erin tightly in her lap and bottle feed her. It seemed really weird to me, them on the couch like that, while I ate a bowl of Kix at the kitchen counter. I witnessed a forced rebirth therapy session, in which Erin seemed to be getting smothered in blankets by the male therapist. They said she was supposed to fight her way out, to go back to the beginning, after which she would, in theory, be ready to bond, like a new baby, with my parents. I walked out partway through the session, while Erin was struggling to emerge from the pile that the therapists were manipulating around her. I wanted these treatments to end, but what did I know? One therapist was grilling Erin about why she tied up our cat in a chair, while the other whispered to us on the other side of the glass that this type of behavior could presage sociopathy. I didn't understand her, but she seemed to know what she was talking about. And they'd tell Erin that she needed to behave better if she wanted to stay in the family. But I didn't muster a word in her defense, thinking about how I once stuffed Noche into a pillowcase long before Erin had done anything to him, hoping no one would find out, so that I wouldn't get kicked out of the family. When I saw how mad my mom got after Erin chewed up a bunch of her chicken and peas and spit it back out onto her plate, I imagined that anger turning toward me and her raised hand pointing, "Out!" I didn't dare say I told Erin it'd be funny if she did it in front of our parents. I didn't possess the loyalty and love that Erin did, though I refused to put foster before sister and said I was committed to her. I wasn't doing the types of things she'd done for her baby brother. She'd risked beatings and getting lost trying to find him food after their mom had gone out looking for drugs and left them alone for days. It was said that Erin couldn't really love, while I was the one standing by, not helping my sibling when she got in trouble. Worse than just standing by, I began to flee when my little sister got in trouble, locked in her room. One night, when Jamie and I were sitting in the hot tub soaking, he asked me, "Is that your sister watching us?" "I don't know. Is she?" I hadn't seen her since lunch. "I think I saw the shade move up there." I looked up from the tub to the silhouette of my sister, pacing her room. "Oh yeah, I think I see it. That's probably her. Maybe she's still in timeout?" "Creepy." "Yeah," I said. "Let's get out of here. Maybe go to your place for the night." We biked away. The reason to fear Erin's roaming freely never seemed quite in hand. There were fleeting insinuations of what might happen, that we had to be careful, in terms that came from the professionals' case files, in a language of expertise inscrutable to children. Over time, I picked up on some of the terms, but what was happening still didn't make sense. Sexual molestation was something that had happened to her, not anything she'd done. "But she might," they suggested. "You have to watch for these things. We have to be sure that doesn't happen." So we watched, locked the locks, left her alone to cry, told her she needed to get it together, built the little things she did wrong, though I'd done worse, into a phantasm that was too scary to let out, too scary to get close to, too scary to keep in the house. Really, she was just a loving little girl, wishing behind a window for a family to choose her, to see all the good in her, and thereby let it out. 11 seasons passed instead of the 2 Erin would typically get with the family, a few Christmases with socks and sweaters and coats wrapped and piled up under the tree, tangerines in the toes of our stockings, one of which had Erin's name sewn into the white velvet top, chocolates and chapsticks, tops and pterodactyl puzzles, under our 15-foot Christmas tree that climbed anew each year to the vaulted ceiling. Erin and I found just about everything we needed, and sometimes more. A cozy pillow that unfolded into a blanket with lions on it, with a pocket to keep your toes warm, a snowboard to go out and get cold. We delivered Thanksgiving dinners and Christmas presents to families seeking holiday help. Though she hadn't always been able to provide for her crying baby brother when she was just a few years old, now she lit up with the ease and joy of taking Tupperwares of potatoes and tins of pumpkin pie out of the trunk of our minivan and carrying them up a few steps to set them on the table of another family with a baby of their own. Then we met for our final family therapy session. "We have decided that Erin will need to go and live in a group home where she can get the full-time support that she needs. She's just not able to be successful in a family at this point." Wailing, "No!" Erin and I slipped together from the furniture down to the place where the rug met the cement, where I'd seen her crying alone. All those times when I'd wanted to go to her, when maybe I could have made it better, and I'd been told to stay back. My parents, suddenly no longer hers, cried quietly on the couch, looking at us, then up at the therapist. I didn't know what group home meant, or understand any of the explanations for why my sister would be sent to one the next week. I knew from Jamie and his siblings what the bond of brotherhood was supposed to entail: taking care of one another, stepping into the toughest places to pull the other out, the responsibility of love was to fix things for the younger ones. Though I had tried to change the adults' minds and find a better way, I unwrapped my arms from Erin when I was told to let her go and headed home. On the way to the bathroom we used to share, I felt the bottom of my rib cage collapsing in. I stood just outside the door frame of her dark bedroom, but didn't go in. I didn't understand. My parents had helped me come to terms with other awful things, like my grandmother's death or a broken arm, by explaining how it worked, the stages of grief, how long an injury would take to heal, what we might be able to do next time to prevent so much pain. This time, though, it just didn't make sense. This had been our house, our mirror in the bathroom where we'd brushed our teeth together, making faces, laughter, and toothpaste frothing over. And now she was somehow someplace I'd never see. She came back to my one and only childhood house a handful of times, on special occasions when, I guess, it's too sad to be in an institution without a family. Thanksgiving, Christmas, her birthday. And eventually, during the increasingly long stretches between visits, I crossed into her room and onto the brown, orange, and green carpet. I approached the windows that looked out on the hot tub and the woods where I'd gotten to grow up, the view through the trees of the lake, the foothills, and, on a clear day, the snow-capped mountains. Even on windless days, when the evergreens presided stilly outside her windows and no one else was around, the quiet room felt chaotic, full of lingering tumult. Someone amazing had once been here, had been playing Chinese checkers and giggling, jumped up and down on the bed with me, had been torn away from here. Now, I had two bedrooms to myself. I no longer had to share anything, but I didn't get to share my life. I thought about how, one day, when my parents would die and I would be wrecked, as my mom had been when Grandma died, no one would understand. No one would share the pain with me. No one but me would survive this family. Why me? And why her? Like this. We had been a we, and now she was a she, and I, incomplete. Chapter 2. Since Erin's old room had my old bunk bed in it, Jamie and I eventually started going in for sleepovers, filling the darkest hours of the night with whispered wonderings about the reaches of the universe. We tore through the somberness of the space with farts and laughter. What was I to do but gradually stop thinking about her? I'd been given answers that I didn't know how to question, by professionals and parents who treated me really well. I was becoming a teenager, busy trying to figure out my own life. After summer overnights in my place, Jamie and I would hop on our bikes and speed around the corner, where I stashed my helmet in a bush and rode the trail down to his place. On previous trips alone to Jamie's house, on the last hill before his cul-de-sac, I'd turn around after hearing his mom from a block off yelling things like, "Jamie, you little shit, get your ass in here and do these dishes now! I'm not playing!" Jamie's house seemed full of a volatile, raucous love that I'd never experienced. I never knew what was going to happen, which was exciting, coming from a relatively quiet and mild-mannered home and always able to bike back there. On this trip down, he sat up straight as we rounded the corner and said, "I'd better stop to check in before we go down to the lake. Just wait here." He threw his brother's bike down onto the grass and sprang over the gap in the deck to disappear through the red front door. I sat crisscross next to the bikes and picked up a worm. So far, so good. I didn't hear, "Get your ass in here," or "You little shit," or "You're grounded." And eventually, Jamie slipped quietly back out of the house, jumped down the steps, and told me to bike fast across the neighbor's lawn so they wouldn't see us. Emerging onto a dirt road, we sped by an old, burned-out house. But I saw only good things, the tread of our tires integrating perfectly into the two dirt tracks we rode, fast, side by side, pedal for pedal, separated only by a ribbon of grass.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?